Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. The Climate Cast is coming up at the top of the 10 o'clock hour, but now in depth on the people Donald Trump is choosing for his cabinet. The revolving doors at Trump Tower have been busy with job applicants coming and going, and we're starting to get a sense of how the president-elect's cabinet is shaping up. But what do we know about how he's choosing these leaders, where they come from, what their selection says about the future of the agencies that they're heading up? As our guests join us to talk about this, I'd like you to think about this. The president-elect has put some Washington outsiders into some key positions. Wilbur Ross as Commerce Secretary, Ben Carson at HUD, Linda McMahon at the SBA. Now, whether you voted for Donald Trump or not, do you think beyond the Beltway experience ends up being an important qualification for these government agencies? So as we talk about their qualifications, the chemistry of the cabinet, what we're understanding about the government that Donald Trump wants to run, I'm asking you whether you think experience outside of Washington ends up being pretty important as you think about what the administration is going to do and you think about the future of these agencies. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. We're at nprnews.org/live. I'm on Twitter at @CarrieNPR. Reid Galen is with us. He's a former Republican campaign manager, including working for John McCain and Arnold Schwarzenegger. He heads up a public affairs consultant firm, and he's with us today from Park City, Utah. Reid, welcome back to the show. It's good to talk to you again.
You too. Thanks for having me.
Van Newkirk is with us. He's a policy and political reporter at The Atlantic and writing about the politics of this, and he joins us from D.C. And Van, welcome back. It's good to have you on the show.
All right, thanks for having me.
Van, some political observers have said that the cabinet selection process resembles, you know, this version of The Apprentice. People were starting to say that right after the election. But here's my question. Is the way that President-elect Trump is doing this all that unusual? Are you seeing something different here?
Well, I think especially with the Secretary of State process that seems to be tweeted about, and we've got multiple people coming in and coming out, and also what seems to be a level of misdirection by the transition team in sort of with their media, with their press, how they're reaching out to the press and talking about who they're picking and who they might not pick, that seems to be a little bit unprecedented.
Okay, so when you say misdirection, Van, you mean kind of deliberately putting out some red herrings about who might be in the mix?
Right. There seems to be a little bit of that happening.
What do you think the value or the purpose of that is?
Well, I think it's a transition team that values unpredictability and also values sort of culturally going against what's expected of an establishment candidate. So they, I think, embrace that little bit of misdirection.
Yeah. Reid, is there a purpose for that? Is that a technique that, you know, while most president-elects don't employ, there's a good reason to do it?
There might be. I would say that, you know, it might be misdirection on purpose, but given the way that Donald Trump has run his campaign from the moment it started last summer, 2015, it very well could just be this is how they operate. And this sort of, you know, unconventional style is just something that all of us are going to have to get used to for at least the next 4 years.
You know, Reid, much was made of, as Van has said, the Secretary of State bringing in people that were critical of Donald Trump. As it turns out, even though we're hearing that he's interested in talking to some of his critics, as it turns out, only one has made the cut, and that's Nikki Haley at UN. So does that tell you anything? Is he really that interested in surrounding himself with people that didn't agree with him?
Well, I mean, you know, we should step back and remember that most cabinet picks for winning, you know, for newly elected presidents tend to be allies of those people. So this is not an entirely unusual thing. The difference was this year is that so many establishment Republicans were so deeply vested in seeing Donald Trump defeated that a lot of the people who would normally get these jobs, you know, are not even in the running. So is it unusual, you know, that he doesn't have that many people, you know, who disagree with him, you know, in the mix. Not that much. But again, because so many people within his own party wanted little, if anything, to do with him, it takes on more importance.
That's a good point. Van, do you think there's a good argument? I hear what Reed is saying here. It's not all that common that presidents will bring in, you know, a large number of their critics to serve in their cabinet. Is there a good reason to do it?
Well, I think there is for Trump, especially because of that, what we just said, the recent rift within the Republican Party. This is a good way, I think, to bring in rivals, bring in people who did criticize him, would be a good way to shore up the party going into 2018 and 2020, and to actually provide some sort of oversight and provide an incentive for communications between the administration and Congress.
Call here from Al in Eden Prairie. Hey, Al, how are you?
Doing great.
Good. What are you thinking about? Yeah.
Well, I'm thinking, I once I saw that Trump was going to be elected, I thought, okay, well, you know, he talked about draining the swamp. He talked about insiders and things like that being bad. And I was kind of going, well, this will be interesting. I'm kind of all for that. Let's see what bringing in some new blood will do, and et cetera. And I've been watching for the last few weeks, and pretty much, you know, I'm guessing at least 50%, if not more, of people he's talking about are people that any other politician on the right would have probably been happy to pick. So I guess I don't understand. Maybe it's just he was saying once he's elected, and like a typical politician changes his mind once he gets elected.
Right.
But, you know, what? I guess I don't understand the thought process that's going through his head if he's, you know, saying one thing, you know, doing another, other than the fact that more of the same, which is really, I guess, kind of disappointing. Not that I agree on all the policies he's talking about.
Al, your phone's breaking up a little bit. Reed, I think I hear Al saying, it sounded like he might make some rather unconventional selections for the cabinet. Are you seeing some of that?
I mean, I think that certainly Linda McMahon for the Small Business Administration is probably a little bit outside the norm, also not a full cabinet agency. So, you know, there's something to be said for that. But I think generally speaking, you know, the people he has chosen have not been outside the norm as far as where these folks typically come from. I mean, the idea that you have a billionaire running the Commerce Department, I mean, you can go back probably, you know, into the 70s, I would guess, and find somebody like that. Even President Obama's current Commerce Secretary is a billionaire from Chicago. So that's not that unusual. You know, a lot of these people, you know, you talked about at the top, you know, they don't have a lot of government experience. Most of the folks who run these cabinet agencies will not have a ton of government experience. They come from the business world. They come from the donor class. So this is not, you know, in Treasury, they typically come from Wall Street or somewhere nearby. So that's not particularly unusual. I think the fact that these are people who are so absolutely tied by loyalty to Donald Trump, you know, is really the news of the day. And obviously the number, I think, three major generals, or, you know, when I say major generals, senior generals being appointed to the cabinet is also something we haven't seen, you know, in a long time.
It's a good point. I want to come back to how heavily President-elect Trump seems to be relying on the military establishment. But I think Al used that phrase that Donald Trump used a lot in the campaign, which is drain the swamp. Here's how he talked about it during the campaign.
And we are going to end the government of corruption, which it has definitely been. And we're going to drain the swamp in Washington, D.C.
Is, Van, in your view, well, you know what? Let me put my perspective on how you see that. How do you hear that? And then how do you link that up with what you're seeing the president-elect do?
Well, what I think I hear drain the swamp is sort of a promise to change the way Washington works, to go in and change the way the cabinet works, to go in and find people who are outside the Beltway, maybe, in thinking about who's going to be leading the country. And I think Donald Trump has actually gone in the exact reverse in this election so far. So what, we have three, I think, billionaires sort of on the economic side of things,
yeah,
and three generals now in the security portion of the cabinet. And I think the only two real outside picks you would say that were unconventional are Carson at HUD and also now Pruitt at EPA. And those are, at least HUD is always considered sort of a backwater for the president now. And I think Pruitt is going to really be the only real example of draining the swamp I can think of.
We have a caller here who wants to talk about HUD to Joey in Minneapolis. Hi, Joey.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What are you thinking about?
So I have a school background with urban planning, and my concern with Ben Carson and HUD is, I understand the desire from Americans to drain the swamp and frustration with the status quo, but when you have really complicated tasks of agencies like HUD and a history of many, either failed policies or past discrimination within public housing or within just kind of how our system is set up, I feel all of the complicated history and politics within this makes it so that somebody with a lot more experience is just completely necessary. So I'm very concerned about somebody who doesn't understand all of the really unfortunate events that have happened with some issues in the past with urban planning when it comes to urban renewal or public housing. And just, I would want someone who had a lot more experience with these policies.
Okay.
Yeah,
Joey, it's a really good point. And Reed, I want to note here that although Van notes that it has been considered a backwater, HUD has a budget of $50 billion and it has more than 8,000 employees. And the decisions that HUD makes can affect the everyday lives of people. What happens when you have somebody who's never run a bureaucracy like this? Does it matter if you've got a lot of institutional staffing there who can basically run the agency?
Well, I mean, they already do. All of these agencies do, from HUD to Ag to any of these major cabinet agencies. You know, the number of political appointees within them is minuscule compared to the bureaucrats, the civil servants who will stay for years, if not decades. We should also remember, too, that so many of the programs within a department like HUD have been set in place by legislation, over years, if not decades. And so, there's something to be said for the experience in running a large bureaucracy. But for the most part, what you have seen in the past, I'd say if not three administrations, is that, a cabinet secretary is less a manager and more a cheerleader for a given program or policy position that the White House wants to push.
So you're saying that the cabinet secretary at an agency like HUD, or let's just even say the EPA, is really not going to make policy? They're going to be out there talking about the policy as it flows from the Oval Office.
Well, I would say this. I mean, I think to Van's earlier point, someone like, the Oklahoma Attorney General Pruitt at EPA, I mean, he could very well have a dramatic impact on that agency because he was put there specifically for that reason, right? If Donald Trump was looking to somehow assuage the concerns of the environmental community, he would have found somebody far more sort of down the road on those issues. He found someone who I believe is in active lawsuits or has had active lawsuits against the agency for years.
Right.
So that is one situation in which, the president-elect is looking to make major policy changes. I think that Dr. Carson getting HUD, is, again, someone who came on board with Donald Trump shortly after his own campaign ended and will be someone who I think, at least as far as I can surmise, is someone who the president-elect or the administration believes can speak to the urban community. Whether or not that happens is certainly another question.
Van, what would you say to that last point on Ben Carson and HUD? Yeah.
He does have, I guess, a personal background growing up in urban low-income communities. But I think Carson's, the only sort of evidence we can find that he's evinced on housing policy has been his support for mostly rolling it back. And Carson seems like he'll at least sponsor a similar approach to HUD that Pruitt might at EPA.
Van Newkirk is one of our guests. If you've just tuned in, he's a reporter on politics and policy at The Atlantic. And Reed Galen is with us. He's a Republican strategist and commentator. As we talk about what we're now, I think from taking a look at some of the people that President-elect Trump is putting into some key positions in his cabinet, understanding about which agencies that he really wants to bring change to, how these people's qualifications and their insider or outsiderness fits with the agencies that they'll be running. We haven't talked yet about security, although I will tell you we did a whole show on national security. You can find that in the archives, NPR News with Carrie Miller, of course, on the podcast. But both Van and Reed have noted that President-elect Trump is leaning hard on the military establishment, so we'll talk about what that means. I'm also asking you this morning that the president-elect has made a big point of saying he wants to bring people in from outside of Washington. He's done that to a certain degree. Ben Carson at HUD, as I mentioned. Wilbur Ross, as noted, a billionaire for commerce. Linda McMahon, we just learned this, for the Small Business Administration. Is that an important element to you, the beyond the beltway experience, an important qualification as a voter, as a supporter of Donald Trump's or not, for someone to run these agencies? 651-227-6000-800-242-2828. And on Twitter here at Carrie NPR, where a listener says interviewing critics for jobs might also be a way to find out Koch brothers' strategies to anticipate and maneuver. Barry says complex organizations need institutional memory of at least some experienced insiders. And to the phones to Whitney in Minnesota. Hey, hi, Whitney.
Hi. I was going to say what others have already pointed out, that he's putting in people in charge of organization, well, they hate the organizations, EPA and HUD, and education, the woman in charge of education, as far as I understand.
Betsy DeVos, yes.
Wants everything private, and which is a very bad idea. If you look into charter schools, that they're experimenting with things that fail in the middle of kids' education, and she wants to take apart public housing, public schooling.
Yeah, let me say this about that. Betsy DeVos is in favor of vouchers in charter schools. I don't know if she hates the Department of Education, if she wants to take apart public education. But what's the signal, Reed Galen, that was one of the first picks that Donald Trump made, of putting someone like, sure, Betsy DeVos, with her interests, in charge of that agency?
Sure. Well, I mean, you know, one thing I think that whether or not you are a Democrat or a Republican or a conservative or a liberal is that, you know, if you go back 8 years, you know, a lot of people on the right were absolutely appalled by the people that, you know, then President-elect Obama chose for his cabinet. And now we see the same thing happening on the left. And, you know, it's an old trope, but, you know, elections have consequences.
Right.
The Republican nominee won the presidency. And we should not be surprised, no one should be surprised, that they are putting conservative people into cabinet agencies. This is what happens when you have a major shift in political parties in Washington, D.C. For someone like Betsy DeVos, look, you know, whether or not you agree with her policies on charter schools or vouchers or whatever, you know, clearly, you know, voters across this country, at least in the states that mattered in the Electoral College, wanted radical change. And you can make an argument that whether or not you believe in public schools, whether or not you agree with teachers' unions, American public education has been falling behind for decades. And if we need a new direction, it seems that the American people are perfectly willing to at least take a shot on that.
And, Van, we should also say here that some of what she wants to do is going to be, I mean, if she's really going to lean into the voucher and charter school issue. I mean, Congress just passed last year a big education bill. This is not going to be as easy as just saying, well, this is the direction we're now headed, is it?
I don't think it will be, especially with the Department of Education, which has always had a bit of a jurisdictional conflict with state and local school districts and governments. So I think the authority that the Secretary of Education will have moving forward to implement, to sort of push for national vouchers, to push for privatization of schools to the extent that Betsy DeVos wants to do, I'm not quite sure we've settled exactly what the Department of Education's role is in that process.
Well, and what do you mean by that? I mean, what kinds of questions do you have about that?
So exactly what kinds of initiatives can be put in place, how they can leverage federal funding of education to, say, move local districts towards a voucher program.
Got it.
What the secretary can actually do on that front.
Yeah, Reed, would you weigh in on that too?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think that if you the amount of paperwork, the amount of red tape that a local district must compete with in order to stay in compliance with the federal Department of Education to thereby receive federal funding for their schools is monumental. And so I think if Ms. DeVos can bring a semblance of sanity to that process, where I think, again, if you were left, right, or center on education policy, but half you are an administrator at a local school district, knowing that you must traverse this Byzantine path in order to stay in compliance with federal rules, if she can clear out some of that underbrush, some of that red tape, my guess is that, at least on the administrative side, you might see some people being pretty happy about it. But again, yeah, I mean, the authority within the executive is very, they do have a lot of authority. But again, a lot of that stuff also comes from legislation that is years, if not decades, in place. And whether or not she can climb out from under that in 4 years is a tough task.
On Twitter, these aren't outsiders, they're cronies. The McMahon family were among the Trump Foundation's largest donors, and then added in another tweet, the bigger problem with Trump's appointments is that they're almost all failed politicians. He's appointing the unelectable. I don't know if that's true. I mean, Scott Pruitt was elected attorney general in Oklahoma. Jeff Sessions is an incumbent senator. Van, does that appear to be true to you?
You've also got Price at Health and Human Services now.
Yeah.
These are very successful politicians. I think maybe the argument holds for Carson and perhaps to a lesser extent Haley.
Mm-hmm.
But Price, Sessions, and Pruitt have been very successful, and that's, I think, exactly why they were appointed to their cabinet positions.
They also have connections in Congress, which is no small thing, is it?
Right, and just to interrupt, remember, too, that Ben Carson ran for one office. He ran for president. Nikki Haley was reelected as governor of South Carolina. The only person you can make the argument as being a failed politician, or at least a failed candidate, would be Linda McMahon.
I see. To the phones to Bill in River Falls. Hi, Bill.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
A comment and then a question for your panel. So my comment is, I think generally the electorate has a poor ability of cause and analysis, because if they want to drain the swamp, they basically sent about 90% of Congress back to Congress. So if they really felt the swamp was their problem, they didn't really try to solve it.
Mm-hmm.
But my question to your panel is, I have a hypothesis that this is really a Pence presidency, and that as long as they can keep Trump in front of adoring crowds and give him small victories like getting $50 billion back from Boeing on the jets, and everyone can pat this narcissist back, that it's really going to shape up to what Pence has done to Indiana. And I'm wondering if your panel can comment how much of what they see, policy, personnel, maybe mimics what Vice President-elect Pence has done to Indiana.
That's a really good question, Bill. Thank you. Reed, would you tackle that one first?
Sure. I mean, I think that the Vice President-elect's authority will be solely based on what Mr. Trump delegates to him, much like we saw with President Bush and Vice President Cheney. Certainly, Pence brings an experience both in Washington as a legislator and in Indiana as an executive, which I think is hugely helpful in a White House that is bereft of much experience at that level. As far as, doing to the country what he did to Indiana, I would say that Indiana is far more conservative on the mean than the country writ large. So I think his value to President Trump is probably more on the management and moving policy prescriptions through the legislative process than trying to turn America into Indiana. That's not to say that he doesn't very, strongly hold those beliefs. But I think he is, I don't want to call him a functionary, but certainly he's almost a prime minister type moving through with the legislature.
You know, Van, I've been contemplating a version of that question that Bill is asking about whether, the real governing is going to be done by Pence, who has a great interest in that, and whether Donald Trump is content, to kind of dip in when he's interested and then do a lot of the kind of, I think as Bill put it, get out there in front of the adoring crowds. I mean, maybe that's the kind of arrangement that would work for this administration. Not good for all presidents, but maybe for this one. What do you think?
Well, I think Pence being assigned to the transition team does show that he will have a larger role than some vice presidents in the past in creating policy and establishing the way the administration looks. But I do think Trump is still going to be the man in charge. And again, like we said, he's going to be the one delegating the authority to Pence and with the power to take it away also. And I think the one place where we're looking where Pence might have the most direct impact on policy is actually health. So in addition to Price at HHS, we now have Seema Verma at Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. And she actually was the lead architect for Pence's health care plan, his private Medicaid hybrid deal in Indiana. And she also helped build most of Indiana's general health care structure.
So when you look at the combined experience of that, let's also acknowledge that whatever they're going to do with regard to the ACA has got to go through a pretty complex vetting process within Congress. And members of Congress have a lot of different ideas about that. Yes?
Yes. ACA is incredibly, incredibly complex. And I doubt we'll see a full move to repeal or even replace it in the next few months. I think it's going to take a while.
Reed, but I'm sorry, Van, go ahead. Sorry to interrupt.
But you have to remember the Secretary of Health and Human Services has a much larger purview than the ACA programs and is in control of most of the public health apparatus of the country.
A couple things to follow up there on Reed. Do you agree with Van that it's going to take longer than the administration has been saying and would want to do something with the ACA?
Yeah, I agree for a few reasons. One, because there, I think, are some provisions within Obamacare that are very popular among Americans. And secondly, and this is, I think, something that has always been most difficult for Republicans on what you would replace the ACA with, is that no matter what you're going to replace it with, it's going to cost money. And the last thing in the world they are prepared to or really want to admit to is that whatever health care system you replace Obamacare with, there will be a cost associated with that. So I think that, it's not that there's a shortage of healthcare policy experts, conservative policy experts on the Hill, or, Mr. Price headed to HHS. It's that, okay, what are you going to do? Are you really going to tell, especially, these Trump voters, suburban, maybe exurban, Anglo voters in Kentucky or Michigan or wherever, that suddenly, look, you had health care under Obamacare. Now you're not going to have anything. You're really going to send those people back to lacking coverage completely? I think it's a very hard thing for them to accomplish in short order.
Van, I think this is why Harry Reid, who was on NPR this morning, said in an interview with Rachel Martin that Republicans are going to repeal it to the ACA to their peril. You think that's right?
I believe so. Yeah. You look at places in the Rust Belt especially. Look at West Virginia, Kentucky, Michigan, places that have really faced the huge economic effects that I think Trump sold in his way to victory. Those are the places that have actually benefited almost the most from the Affordable Care Act's expansions of Medicaid. They've given affordable coverage to coal miners who have black lung, people like that. And I think it's going to be really difficult to sell, okay, we're getting rid of your insurance and we're going to give you a voucher or a health savings account. I don't know if a lot of people are going to enjoy that.
Do I remember this right, that the Republican governor of Kentucky ended up expanding Medicaid and, I mean, was a proponent of much of the ACA? Do I have that right?
Right.
I think he was one of the first governors actually to go out there and say, yes, we'll expand Medicaid. Van might know better than I, but I'm almost positive that's the case.
So Van, your point of, well, all of you that in a state like Kentucky that, supported Donald Trump, this is what that looks like. Go ahead.
I think the game here is people in Kentucky love their insurance. When you refer to it as Connect, is what they call it in Kentucky. Mm-hmm. When you refer to it or call the Medicaid expansion or their subsidized health care, when you refer to it as Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act, support plummets, which is, I think, an interesting part of this whole thing. I think if Republicans, they have their out, if they can find a way to sort of rebrand and repackage the main provisions of Obamacare as a private market type deal without actually changing a whole lot of the big ticket items.
Van Newkirk with us from The Atlantic. Reed Galen with us, a strategist, longtime Republican strategist and a commentator and a consultant, having a conversation this morning about what we're understanding about the people that Donald Trump is going to surround himself with in the new administration, in the cabinet, what that tells us about the way those agencies will be run and the way the administration will be run. And then we're talking a lot about the policy that confronts these agencies. Talked about HHS. We've talked about the EPA a bit. I am going to come back to this, the idea of putting some of these ex-military people or current military people in charge, and what that tells us about issues of national and international security. 651-227-6000 for your questions. 800-242-2828 to talk to us about this idea of bringing outsiders into the inside and whether that's an important level of experience for this cabinet. And on Twitter, at Carrie NPR. It's the news now, and Phil Picardi. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Carrie. Donald Trump says his administration strongly believes in environmental protection, but environmentalists say the man Trump has chosen to head the Environmental Protection Agency does not have any such commitment. Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt is a global warming skeptic, and he says Americans are tired of unnecessary EPA regulations that he says are draining billions of dollars from the nation's economy. A strong earthquake has been reported off the coast of Northern California. The quake had a magnitude of 6.5. The U.S. Geological Survey says the quake was centered about 100 miles off the Pacific Ocean west of Ferndale, California. There was no tsunami warning, and no injuries or damage have been reported. Defense attorneys are asking for a mistrial in Dylan Roof's death penalty trial in Charleston, South Carolina. They say the testimony from a survivor that he is evil and belongs in the pit of hell was inappropriate. Roof is on trial on 33 federal counts, including hate crimes, in the 2015 shooting deaths of 9 black parishioners during a Bible study at Emmanuel AME Church. Life expectancy in the U.S. has been rising for decades, but now that trend could be coming to an end. The numbers declined last year, and life expectancy is now no better than it was 4 years ago. The decline was unusual for a year that did not include a major disease outbreak. Other one-year declines occurred in 1993, when the nation was in the throes of the AIDS epidemic, and in 1980, the result of an especially nasty flu season. And Greg Lake, co-founder of the rock bands King Crimson and Emerson, Lake & Palmer, has died. He was 69 years old. Lake's manager said in a statement Lake died yesterday after a long and stubborn battle with cancer. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:38.
Hey, if you weren't able to catch our show on Anatomy of a Song with Mark Myers, we played a ton of music. We talked about the backstories of a lot of the songs that we recognize. It was a lot of fun. And if you missed it, you can find it on the podcast NPR News with Carrie Miller on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And then let me know what you think on Twitter at Carrie NPR.
Support comes from Catholic Charities of St. Paul in Minneapolis, dedicated to ending poverty for thousands experiencing homelessness in our community. You can help provide shelter and food with gifts matched through December 31st at cctwincities.org/donate.
Our climate cast is, as always, on Thursdays at the top of the 10 o'clock hour. We are talking about the implications of the warming of the Arctic Ocean and the Arctic in general on the food chain. As you know, we always talk about the science of climate change on Thursday morning. So that's coming up at 10. Our conversation this hour about the cabinet, Reed Galen with us and Van Newkirk with us, and a call here from Kevin in Cottage Grove. And Kevin, thanks so much for waiting. What are you thinking about?
So when your folks were talking about, you know, shaking things up and how these choices are very different because it's a new administration, you know, one of the things that stands out to me is I see a real similarity in all these choices is the word privatization. We've heard it with the education nominee. Continually we hear it around prisons and all the things that could be taken, you know, private. I've always been a supporter of the idea of privatizing some, you know, education and some of these other things to give some competition there. But I think in recent months we've seen where, you know, reports are that a lot of the privatization of schools hasn't worked. Privatization of prisons hasn't worked.
Okay.
The privatization of Social Security, I think, is a horrible idea. But that's the one consistent thing I see out of this cabinet is a really strong push to privatize as much as they possibly can.
Yeah, Kevin, let's see what our guests have to say about that. Reed, is that what you're intuiting as well from these selections?
I mean, certainly, I think that it's probably more of a step-by-step process. I would guess that before you can truly privatize anything, you probably need to streamline the way it works. I think that there is, you know, the last major shakeup in the federal bureaucracy was post 9/11, and previous to that, I think, was the National Security Act of 1947. So we've had this incremental, you know, mission creep and growth over the course of the last few decades that, you know, has now led to millions of federal workers, tens of thousands of duplicative federal programs that probably cost a lot of money, not enough to certainly make a real dent in our debt. But privatization, again, remember that a lot of this stuff has to go through Congress. There are a lot of those things that members of Congress, both Republican and Democrat, are going to take very close looks at, especially how it affects their state or their district. And, you know, they have to take the long view of these things. They're often in office far longer than presidents. And so while, you know, privatization may be the dream of some of these cabinet members, a much more difficult thing to get done.
You know, Van, I think of someone like Paul Ryan and some of what he talked about when he was a vice presidential candidate. Now, he's got some experience on this idea of talking about privatization. They would be quite cautious, as Reid suggests, wouldn't they?
I think so. And Reid's right. The main thing in the way with privatization, education and health care and some of the functions that all these cabinets hold is legislation. And so I think Reid's instinct there is right. I think Congress would probably move to streamline government before they moved to implement broader privatization plans, I guess, beyond health care, because I think that would be a first order act item.
Mark in Burnsville says, after 60-plus votes on repeal of the ACA and still no plan to replace it, what is wrong with the GOP? Reid, what is wrong with the GOP when it comes to just because it's so difficult to come up with something that people would agree with?
Well, yeah, I mean, first and foremost, remember that those 60 votes were all symbolic. You know, they weren't ever going to go anywhere. Certainly, half the time they didn't own the Senate, and President Obama was never going to sign the repeal of what will be his landmark legacy piece of legislation. I think, secondly, you know, when it comes to health care, it is so personal and so entrenched in our lives. And then politically as well, you know, it's not just whether or not, you know, person A in Ottumwa, Iowa is going to get their health care via an exchange or via a private insurer, is that, you know, the insurance industry has a very vested interest in this. We've already seen several of the larger providers saying they're going to walk out of the exchanges because the costs are too high. The pharmaceutical industry has a lot to do with this. These are industries that spend, you know, tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars on an annual basis on lobbying. So what you start to see is this political tsunami of policy, politics, money, and a lot of these folks not really wanting to get crossways with people that have been their benefactors for many years.
Call here from Erica in Rosemont. Hi, Erica.
Hi. And I guess just on that last thing, my comment would be the GOP, small government, I mean, do they really want, you know, federal government to be controlling a health care program for the country? So my question is, I heard last week that there's this sort of 5 years expiration to be able to replace Obamacare. Mm-hmm. So couldn't the Republicans just put together legislation over the next 5 years that has elements that Democrats would just never support, so that Democrats vote no and they have some Republicans to vote no, and then 5 years it can expire and Republicans can blame the Democrats for not putting together a program to replace it?
Van, this is an interesting question.
I've actually thought this one through a little bit, especially in the near future. It does seem possible that Republicans could, I don't know if it has to be purposeful. I think a lot of their plans that do exist, Price's is maybe the most comprehensive, they haven't been scored yet. They haven't gone through the paces. They're incomplete. And they would likely lead to a collapse of the healthcare system. And I think Republican consultants on the issue know that. And pushing those plans through, these untenable plans through, might, you know, ensure that enough Republicans don't support it and Democrats don't support it to where there is no vote. And I think that actually might be a reasonable outcome to expect, at least over the next year.
That's interesting. You know, Reid, again, this is the first time I've heard someone say, look, part of the reason that they don't really have a plan is because it's going to be so expensive. Can you put a number on that, or is it just too hard to tell?
I am the furthest thing from a health policy expert.
Okay, so I gotcha.
I would not even begin to put a cost on it, but I think it will be significant. We have an aging population. We have a population in many of the states that we've been talking about today, you know, the Rust Belt, the Appalachia, you know, where health issues, whether or not it is, you know, black lung. If you've been a coal miner, we see this, huge spike in opioid addiction. So there are just a lot of things that, you know, we never take into account for when we start designing policy, or when members of Congress or legislators start deciding what policy is going to look like. So there's going to be a cost involved, right? And I think that is, you know, the thing that no one on Capitol Hill wants to admit, especially if you think about this, that if President-elect Trump's first thing is $1 trillion in infrastructure spending,
yeah,
interesting to see how much more credit on the government credit card Republicans on Capitol Hill give them for something like healthcare.
That's a good point. Yeah, I do want to say we did a number of health policy shows right after the election. Steve Parente was with us from the Carlson School. But we didn't specifically talk about options for different ways to change the ACA, but we didn't have any specific numbers at the time for that. And you can find those shows, if you're really interested in health policy, as I am, you can find those shows on the podcast. Just search NPR News with Kerry Miller on iTunes. I do want to talk about the military here. We've got retired General James Mattis as Secretary of Defense, retired General John F. Kelly, Secretary of Homeland Security. General Petraeus is apparently in the running for Secretary of State. Van, what does this tell you, if anything, that Donald Trump is turning to the military for some of these key positions?
Well, I think Donald Trump ran as a candidate of law and order, and this is his show that he is a candidate of law and order, whatever that means to you. I think what it means maybe immediately is we're going to see some of the moves towards domestically demilitarization of police. Things like that will probably roll back, especially given that they receive a lot of those militarized weaponry and gear from Homeland. So I think we're going to see that roll back immediately. But I'm not sure how much is going to change in terms of our larger defense policy right away.
I should also say Michael Flynn for National Security Advisor. He's a retired Army Lieutenant General. Reed, what's your thought on this?
I mean, I think for someone like General Mattis, it makes perfect sense. This is someone who I think is not only, a longtime soldier, a longtime professional, well thought of in military circles and national security circles. But to Van's point, you know, Donald Trump loves a strong leader. And, you know, generals are the archetype of the strong leader. They march to the front of the column of their troops. They lay down the orders and, you know, they say, march forward, go do your jobs. And I think that both defense and Homeland are unique in that defense obviously has the military, and Homeland is at its core an enforcement agency. And, you know, so unlike, you know, the State Department or HHS or wherever these other things where you could have a lot of obstruction by the bureaucracy. A lot of these, at least these two agencies, you have people who are used to taking orders for a living.
I was reading something that Fawaz Jurjiz, he's an international policy expert and an author, and he is not a fan of Donald Trump. I will say this, but he was talking about the national security choices, and he noted Mike Pompeo for CIA, Michael Flynn for national security, Mattis for defense. And he said, sadly, Trump traffics in a similar clash of civilizations narrative to that of Al-Qaeda and ISIS. They all view the world in binary terms. What Trump and his followers don't get is that their inflammatory rhetoric plays into the hands of ISIS and Al-Qaeda, who labor hard to convince skeptical Muslims that the West is waging a war against Islam. I mean, Michael Flynn has been very specific on his views on that, and I think Fawaz Jurjiz has them pretty right. Van, what would you add?
I think that's something, especially that Muslims in this country should be reasonably worried about, is when a person who says that people should be afraid of Muslims is in charge of our domestic security apparatus, is in charge of our surveillance apparatus, and thinking about Trump's moves away from the idea of a registry, you know, he's trying to recalibrate those positions. I think it should put some hearty skepticism in the hearts of people who would be affected by that when you name someone like Flynn to your cabinet.
We have a good question here from Twitter. Given Donald Trump's Twitter war with Boeing, this listener asks, had any of these generals come out in support of cutting military spending to save taxpayer dollars? Have you heard anything like that, Reid?
I have not in particular, but, you know, I think that, you know, if your job is to build an army and you need dollars to build an army, you're probably always going to want to get more. I think that, you know, there was just a report out in the Washington Post about the fact that the Pentagon had squashed a report that's, you know, had outlined $125 billion worth of wasteful spending. 1 million back office staffers at the Pentagon or within the DOD. I think those are the kinds of things that if General Mattis, you know, wants to be both a leader and a firm administrator, can start to take those things on. But, you know, as you know, the military industrial complex is a very powerful lobby, and they will do what they can to ensure that their dollars remain in the budget.
You know, check me on my facts on this. I thought the military was still under sequester, and so the spending was limited on that. Van, is that not right?
That's not my expertise. I think that might
okay.
be something Reid might
I'm
be
not
able
sure.
to answer.
Yeah. Reid, do you know?
I mean, I think they are, and I think that was what concerned the Pentagon so much, was that they, you know, had been claiming for years that, yes, they didn't have enough money to operate. They didn't have enough money for this. They didn't have enough money for that.
Right.
But they did have, you know, $125 billion laying around that they were pretty much just wasting. I think the figure the Post quoted was that was enough money over, you know, 5 years or whatever it was to fund another 50 brigades.
Jeez.
50. That's a lot. That's
wow.
a lot of, you know, men and women with rifles and helmets and everything else. So, you know, there's all, I mean, the federal budget is so big and so awash in monopoly money at this point that sequester or not, there's always going to be money that's basically lit on fire.
Craig says Trump's drain the swamp promise is really going to become more like ladle the swamp. There's too much of it in Congress. If you want to weigh in via Twitter, by the way, it's @Kerry, KerriMPR, to Doug in Minneapolis. And Doug, thanks so much for waiting. I know it's been a while.
Yeah, no problem. You know, I felt a little insulted by the gentleman earlier who compared people's reactions to Trump's appointees versus what Obama's appointees' reaction was. And because most of these people, I think, are over their heads. They're science deniers. They're trying to push the failed down, trickle-down economic policies. And they're all out to destroy the agencies that they're heading.
I just want to say, I don't know that that's true, that they're all out to destroy these agencies. Now, whittle them, you know, maybe streamline them. I think, Reid, you were saying, and you shouldn't be surprised, that you will have conservative people at the heads of these agencies because Trump won the election.
Right. Yeah. And look, I am not making a value judgment on those people that then President-elect Obama appointed versus who President-elect Trump is appointing. The point I was trying to make to your caller's question or being insulted, certainly that was not my intention, was that you shouldn't be surprised that a Republican president-elect is going to nominate conservative people to cabinet agencies. If you are surprised or upset by that, I am sorry, but you should take a step back and say, well, this is the world we live in, and there are lots of ways that, you know, voters and Americans can show their displeasure. You know, if we talk about the fact that 90% of the members of Congress are reelected, you know, go out and find someone to run against them.
we mentioned Secretary of State at the beginning of the show. We didn't really talk about it. Van, I'm trying to think. I think I read this in the Times this morning that it now appears to be that new people are under serious consideration, and the old group, Rudy Giuliani among them, do not really seem to be under serious consideration. Is that how you would read this?
That's how I would read it, but I'm not sure what's happening, if these are red herrings, if they already have a pick in place and they're just taking the media along for a ride. Or if different people in the transition team actually just have different ideas about who's in the running. These are all possibilities, and I would just wait until it shakes out, because at this point, how can you have any idea?
Reid, I was thinking as I was driving in this morning, thinking about the show, that it was much was made of the fact that President Obama reached back to ask, you know, a rival, Hillary Clinton, to be his Secretary of State. What did we get from that, would you say? I mean, do you have a sense of, with her disagreement with him on some foreign policy issues, that that made him a better decision maker on foreign policy issues?
It might have. Certainly, I think that Secretary Clinton has always been more hawkish on national security than President Obama. I think also it was a canny way for President Obama to unite his own base.
Oh.
To bring her in and say, okay, you know, I'm going to give you the top job in my cabinet, you know, the most vocal, the most visible job, because that would keep, you know, the Democratic base happy. You know, as far as the, you know, but that made the Democratic base happy. I would venture to say that, you know, choosing a Mitt Romney will not satisfy the Republican base. It might satisfy some establishment Republicans, but as being an establishment Republican myself, we seem to be a breed on the verge of extinction.
Huh? Why do you say that?
You know, I mean, just if you look back at the electoral politics of we're off the topic here, but Republican presidential primaries. Generally speaking, you know, if you look back at 2008 with John McCain or 2012 with Mitt Romney, there were populist right-wing insurgents, but they didn't ever have the legs to really take on the establishment choice. Once you got to big purple states or blue states, the establishment choice was going to win out. That did not happen in 2016. The establishment voters either were so upset with how things are going, they too voted for Donald Trump, or they stayed at home, or there's just not as many of them left.
Yeah, you know, I noted in the introduction that you worked for John McCain and Arnold Schwarzenegger. McCain
right.
has at some points in his career been pretty moderate, or Arnold Schwarzenegger, a very moderate Republican. You think those kinds of Republicans are in short supply, huh?
They're in shorter supply than they have been in the past, and as I would say, they probably are on the Democratic side of the aisle too. As the parties themselves have become more polarized, it's harder and harder to find the McCains, the Romneys, or the Arnolds who can appeal to enough Republicans, certainly in a primary setting, to get through to the general.
Reed, really good to have you on the show. Especially, I know it's early in Utah, so thank you.
Thank you,
Van. Your view on what Reed just said about the Democrats? Are they in a similar position?
Well, I think they are. I'm from North Carolina, and mm-hmm. we're a state that has always been known, especially for our blue dog Democrats, right? And in my reporting in the state, I think I've seen that group sort of shrink the smallest in the past 10 years or so.
Really?
And I think a lot of that is because, especially with the rise of Trump, with a very sort of virulent move to root out really Democrats and Republicans who are too centrist in the state government. That's bled in the state politics as well.
Van, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for the time.
Thanks for having me.
Van Newkirk with us from The Atlantic. Reed Galen with us as a public affairs consultant and a former campaign manager and working for John McCain and Arnold Schwarzenegger. At